Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW and heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, Governor Gary Herbert's strong polling in the Republican primary, potential delays for the state of Utah's lawsuit on public lands, high levels of pollution in lakes and waterways in the state, and Utah honors victims of the largest mass shooting in modern history. All that and a good deal more. And I'm joined this morning in studio by Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Robert Gerke. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Also, health, education, and environment reporter Emma Penrod is here.
Good morning.
On the same beat, health, education, and environment reporter Annie Knox is here. Annie, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And managing editor David Noyce is with us as well. David, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
And listeners, you are encouraged to participate in this discussion. Put your comments and questions in the comments section at sltrib.com. Or call us up at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. A lot of topics to cover on the program today. To begin with, let's jump into politics. Robert Gerke, incumbent Gary Herbert appears to have an advantage over Jonathan Johnson in the Republican primary. That's according to some new polling data. What kind of a lead does Herbert have?
It's enormous right now, is what it boils down to. The poll numbers show that if the election were today, Gary Herbert would win 69-24. So it's a 45-point lead. I would anticipate that probably overstates it a little bit. Sometimes when you poll primary voters, people say they're going to vote and then they don't. So I would suspect it would be a little narrower than that. But 45 points is a huge lead, and it's as big as it's been throughout the in any of the polls we've seen throughout the primary competition against them. And so even though Gary Herbert's had some issues with the lobbyist meeting and with his reversal on Common Core and some other things, it doesn't appear to be hurting him with the Republican primary voters at this point. And he looks like he's in pretty good shape to win the election a week from Tuesday.
Well, and this was a poll by the Salt Lake Tribune and the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. Jonathan Johnson's campaign wasn't a big fan of this poll.
No, the Johnson campaign has been saying all along that the race is closer than the polls show, that the polls are overstating Herbert's support. They released their own internal poll that showed him behind by, I believe, 11. They said if they then asked voters questions to educate them, basically told them about the things that Herbert has done wrong during his tenure, raising taxes and whatnot, then the lead actually closes to one. So it's a statistical dead heat. They think they've got momentum. They think that they like what they're seeing on the ground, and they think if they can get their voters out to the polls and to vote, then they're gonna end up winning this thing and pulling an upset. It would be an enormous upset, and we would have to look long and hard at our polling methodology, I guess, at that point, if it turns around by 45 points.
Well, it's all in how you ask the questions, and as you point out, the Johnson campaign asked these educational questions in advance. That's commonly referred to as push polling, where you're trying to influence the outcome of a poll, maybe.
Right. Technically, I guess it's not push polling, because push polling isn't actually used to gather data. In this one, okay. They call them messaging polls, but to test your message. But it's daunting for Johnson at this point, because Herbert was polling better pretty much across the board with every demographic. I mean, even the very conservative voters that you would expect to be very motivated to get out and vote and to vote for Jonathan Johnson were falling slightly into Herbert's camp. So it's an uphill battle. We also looked at head-to-head matchups with the Democrat Mike Weinholz,
right?
And Herbert beats him pretty soundly too right now. I think part of that is that people don't know Mike Weinholz yet. That lead may narrow, or it may end up,
increasing,
staying the same. Yeah.
All right. Well, meanwhile, someone with national and local clout weighed in on this race yesterday. Robert Gerke, what did former GOP presidential nominee Mitt Romney have to say about this race?
Yeah, so the campaign got the endorsement from Mitt Romney yesterday. Not a huge surprise. I mean, he said that Governor Herbert's done a good job helping the economy recover, since the collapse that we were sort of in the throes of when he took office in 2009. Since then, he said that Governor Herbert's kept taxes low and There's been good job creation in the state and invested money in education, and that's why, you know, he encouraged people to vote again for to reelect Gary Herbert.
Will that add to his lead in the polls, I mean, in, and in this race?
It's hard to say. I mean, the lead's pretty big already. I don't know that people who are going to necessarily be swayed by Mitt Romney are already, you know, we're already probably inclined to vote for Gary Herbert. It doesn't hurt, you know, and so the Johnson campaign, again, his campaign manager said that he doesn't think that Romney necessarily has the SWAT that he once did. Although, keep in mind, and I didn't put this in the story and maybe should have, the campaign manager for Jonathan Johnson was also the campaign manager for Mia Love, and they worked really hard to get Mitt Romney's endorsement 2 years ago because they thought it would be a big deal when he was, you know, and when he was, I mean, Mitt Romney, he won 93% of the Republican vote in the Republican presidential primary 4 years ago. So his popularity is pretty much, you know,
through the roof.
Through the roof, yeah.
The Johnson campaign, meanwhile, tweeted out its own endorsement yesterday, kind of in response to this, I guess?
I don't know if it was in response to it, but they did have a video of Wilford Brimley, the guy, the Quaker Oats guy, and what was the TV show he was on?
He was in The Natural. He's Pop Fisher.
Well, he's Pop Fisher in The Natural. Yeah, that was a great role. But he said he's been a longtime friend of the Johnson family and encouraged voters to support for Jonathan Johnson. And I don't know that Wilford Brimley has the SWAT that Mitt Romney does, but, you know, it was an endorsement.
Well, so this is an incumbent governor. As you pointed out, he's got high approval ratings. How did Governor Herbert end up in this primary race anyway?
Right. Well, you know, the delegates who go to convention and end up voting for the nominees are oftentimes more conservative than the electorate in general. And so Governor Herbert, and to be fair, Jonathan ran a pretty effective campaign. He's got a pretty refined, effective message against the governor, that the governor did raise taxes, and the governor has defended the Common Core education standards, and the governor has, has not done some of the things that the conservative Republicans, the very conservative Republicans, would like to see him do. So you get the governor gets into a convention with these delegates who are more strident than the mainstream Republicans, and he ended up losing at the convention 55-45 because Jonathan didn't get 60%. He didn't get the nomination. Also, the governor had gathered signatures, so he was going to be on the primary ballot anyway. So that's how we got here. Ballots for the primary went out earlier this month, I guess 2 weeks ago now, and have to be postmarked by the 27th if you're doing mail-in voting, and then polling places are open on the 28th.
Well, I've got a comment here at sltrib.com. This is by a commenter there, Playing Attention, says that Herbert's big lead just goes to show that the convention is tainted with ideologues, and that as much as people complain about billboards, they work. We've seen a lot of spending on billboards by the Herbert campaign.
The Herbert campaign has been put on the full court press with the billboards. I think your choices for governor appear to either be Governor Herbert or that white horse that is, because they're on every billboard in the city.
Cavalia.
Yeah. Cavalia. It's the most amazing show. So those are pretty much your only choices. No, he's put on the full court press with billboards. You've started seeing radio and TV ads that are airing. Governor Herbert's radio and TV ads tend to be, he's done a good job, let's keep him. And Jonathan Johnson's radio ads have been more focused on, you know, hitting Herbert for the available Jones comments he made in the lobbyist meetings, where he said he's available to meet with donors anywhere, anytime. So that's sort of the attack they've taken. Ultimately, though, these primary races always tend to be about getting your voters out to the polls.
Sure.
And so a lot of the actual campaign work happens behind the scenes, and we don't see it. It's identifying your supporters, making sure that they're going to vote when these mail-in ballots go out. You've got to hit those people over and over and over again to make sure that they get them in. And so a lot of that, that's where these races can be won and lost.
Well, and they're in mailboxes now. This primary election is on June 28th, and then it's on to the general election where, as you said, assuming that the governor makes it out of this primary, he holds a lead against Michael Weinholz. That's a lead that another incumbent Utah Republican doesn't enjoy, and I'm not certain who to turn to on this one. We talked about Mia Love earlier. According to another Tribune Hinckley poll, things are pretty tight in the 4th Congressional District. That's Republican Representative Mia Love against Democrat Doug Owens. How close do the polls put this race right now?
It's just outside of the margin of error. I mean, it's a 5% lead for Doug Owens. And it was a little bit surprising, I think, to a lot of people that, you know, this race 2 years ago was a close race. And 2 years before that, Mia narrowly lost to Jim Matheson. And so this is a district that tends to produce tight races. But I think there was a little bit of surprise when Doug Owens at the beginning of the race was polling ahead. I think the conventional wisdom was that he was going to have to try to close a gap, over the next several months. Dave Hansen, who is Mia's campaign manager, sure. Didn't agree with the poll. He said it's not what they're seeing in their polling, and they feel like she's ahead. The conventional wisdom in political science is that the most dangerous election for an incumbent is their first re-election campaign, and that's where she is right now. There is a sort of discontent and dissatisfaction with Congress generally, and so I think maybe there's maybe that we're seeing that have some impact on her numbers.
Well, there's a little speculation that the competitiveness of this race also has to do conceivably with Donald Trump, right?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately that probably wouldn't be reflected in a poll necessarily because that has more impact on voter turnout, who goes to the ballot boxes. If Republicans don't want to vote for Donald Trump, they're going to stay home, and that has impacts down ticket. Mia Love, though, her negatives, her favorability rating was not very good and not where you would want to see it if you're running for re-election.
Well, and you pointed out that Dave Hansen, who's managing the campaigns of both Jonathan Johnson and Mia Love, took issue with both of these polls. I have to ask, is Dave Hansen running any other campaigns right now?
I think those are the only two he's running right now.
Okay.
It's enough.
Well, so as you said, this was a tight race last time around, and it's bound to be really expensive. I believe it was one of the most expensive races at the time in 2014. The polling is reason for both of these campaigns to be fundraising. I know that Doug Owens released an email asking for funds based on this. So did Mia Love, correct?
Yeah. And Doug, this year, as opposed to 2 years ago, he's going to have support from the National Party. 2 years ago, they kind of, I think, were surprised that race closed up as tight as it did, and they had not invested much money there. There were other races around the country that they were trying to seats they were trying to defend. This year, he's got a commitment from the National Party that they're going to spend some money here, and that could make a big difference. You're right about the fundraising email that went out. I think also based on that poll, the Cook Political Report changed the seat into from a safe Republican seat into a leaning Republican seat. But that's significant, and that's significant for Doug when he goes out and tries to raise money. It's like he can say that this is a seat that we can win, and that's sort of how it's viewed nationally, I think, at this point.
And of course, Mia Love's own fundraising email said, "We are losing," and so you've got
right,
to contribute.
Right.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll revisit other topics. Well, we'll visit other topics, but listeners, don't forget that you are invited to join this conversation. Put your comments at sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-8255. Actually, coming up, 71% of Utah's lakes fail to meet water quality standards. Why is that? We'll explore that topic after the break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Culligan Water of Cache Valley, family owned and operated for more than 65 years, providing Culligan bottled water, salt delivery, or soft and conditioned water. Hey, Culligan man. Service from the man in blue. Online at CulliganLogan.com.
True story, June 2001. A 10-year-old girl named Laura Buxton.
Hello, I'm Laura Buxton.
Let's go of a balloon.
Phew!
That balloon floats 140 miles and lands in the yard of an entirely different girl named Laura Buxton.
They're both Laura Buxton?
Yeah.
No.
Yes.
Maybe we were meant to meet.
Is our world full of magic and meaning?
Strange things do happen by chance.
Or is it just chance? That's next time on Radiolab.
Join us this Saturday at noon on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Robert Gerke, Emma Penrod, Annie Knox, and managing editor David Noyce, and we are digging into this past week's news. Again, you are encouraged to join the conversation commenting at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com, or by calling us 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Health, education, and environment reporter Emma Penrod. A new report by the Division of Water Quality says that 71% of lakes and 43% of streams in Utah don't meet water quality standards. These are standards set for levels of certain pollutants. How do these numbers, 71% and 43%, how do they compare with previous reports, and how alarmed are state regulators about this?
Well, we know that the lakes number is at least a fair bit higher than has been in the past. It's really hard to make direct comparisons, though, and no one's really gone there because the criteria for what qualifies in each report tends to change pretty significantly each year. There's like a whole three chapters dedicated to all the changes that were made just this year.
And this is in terms of what's being measured and how and what they're looking at. Two issues of concern in particular to state officials are levels of heavy metals and then, I guess, for lakes specifically, toxic algae blooms. Mm-hmm. Let's start, I guess, with the heavy metals, because state officials are now investigating whether last year's Gold King mine spill played a role here.
Yeah, that's they discovered on the San Juan River and in Lake Powell, they have discovered, particularly on the San Juan River, elevated levels of metals while the EPA was sampling the river post the Gold King mine spill. It's not clear whether those elevated levels of metals are a direct result of the spill itself, whether they are accumulated from past discharges from that mining district, which we understand has released hundreds of millions of gallons of polluted water over the course of decades, or whether it might be background levels. And so that's what they are trying to understand. They're also trying to understand where the estimated 880,000 pounds of heavy metals that were supposedly released by the Gold King mine during that August incident ended up, because we haven't necessarily seen all of them or can account for all of them in Utah.
Remind us where this spill took place and how it ended up affecting conceivably ended up affecting Utah.
Well, this took place up in what's called the Bonita Peak Mining District in Colorado. That's on it's on a cement creek is what they call it. It's a little tributary of what goes into the Animas River, which then goes into the San Juan River, which ends up in Lake Powell.
Right.
And since there's a dam there, Lake Powell's considered to be more or less probably the final resting place for anything that came out of that spill or came out of those mines.
Okay, so coming down through various tributaries, what's at stake here, and what are regulators monitoring now? You talk about mercury, aluminum, lead, cadmium. Higher levels of these elements have to have an effect or be dangerous for ecosystems, for people, conceivably?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would be dangerous to people if they were in drinking water sources, and the state is monitoring local drinking water sources to make sure that the metals aren't getting into them. But they don't believe that in Utah, drinking water systems are impacted. There's also concern possibly for recreation. If the concentrations are high enough and you got exposed to enough metal while you were out boating or swimming on the lake, that could be potentially bad. They don't think that the levels are high enough to impact recreation, but they're also watching for that. And they are working on creating a warning system that they hope to put on a website with about a year from now, that you could go on this website and see what the river conditions are and whether the metals are high for any reason.
But no warnings yet. I mean, as of yet, about stay out of the water.
That's not finished yet. Okay. And so what they've done right now is they've put in these little devices in the river that measure what's called turbidity. Mm-hmm. It's a measure of how much basically sediment is being kicked up and turned up by the river as it goes by the little devices. And so they are trying to correlate that with the amount of metal that might be in the river. It's been done elsewhere with selenium in Colorado, so they're hoping to replicate that here. But the state's main concern is for the ecosystem and for the wildlife and fish and things that use the river. They're going to be exposed the most.
Are they? These monitors are looking at that. Are they? Are they looking at aquatic life specifically? Catching fish and testing them for.
Yes, that is being done.
Okay.
There haven't been any signs of toxicity in the fish yet, but but it is being done and is being watched.
There's also an interesting sort of mystery here having to do with the pH level of Lake Powell. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and it's not clear whether this is related to the metals or separate from the metals or how this all plays into it. But over the course of 4 years, the state has collected 10 samples where the pH is higher than would be expected and is allowed in Lake Powell for the uses that Lake Powell is designated for with recreation and things. Mm. Now, people get confused with the pH scale.
Sure.
When I say high pH, I'm sure everyone thinks, oh, acidity. No, acidity is low pH. It's actually an alkaline. So when the Gold King mine spill happened, there was a drop in the pH in the rivers immediately below the Gold King mine. It didn't really make it to Utah. But so it did make the water more acidic for a time.
And you would expect
it's not more acidic at Lake Powell, so they aren't sure where that's coming from.
That's interesting. That's a mystery that they're trying to figure out.
Yeah.
Okay, so talking about heavy metals and now pH level at Lake Powell, but also of concern to state regulators from this report, algae blooms. Mm-hmm. This is something that happens in freshwater lakes from time to time, can lead to dangerous conditions for people and pets, as we've seen, also wildlife. What do regulators say about the algae blooms and how to deal with them?
Yeah, well, the State Division of Water Quality has said this is now their top priority in the state, is addressing these algal blooms. Now, it's not 71% of lakes have toxic algae. I've heard someone say that. That's not true. 71% is a combination of many issues. But it's been estimated in the past that about 44% of Utah's waters are at risk for algae blooms. And so in cases, they may include these toxic algae, which make they actually produce chemicals that are toxic and actually quite fatal. I mean, it's not just a, small thing. It could kill you in 20 minutes from exposure.
Well, I remember a couple of years back that there was a dog that died after playing in water at Utah Lake.
There was one confirmed dog that died. They're pretty sure from a toxin called anatoxin A. Mm-hmm. That's the one that can kill you in 20 minutes.
Wow.
The other one, there is another dog that died that they aren't sure why it died, but they think it might have been for the same reason.
These algal blooms, phosphorus from agricultural fertilizers can play a role in fostering conditions to allow them to happen, correct?
Yeah, the algae need basically the same things that all aquatic life need to exist, and so they need food. And they need, in this case, they like warm temperatures. So if the temperature of the lake is elevated and there's nutrients in the lake, like phosphorus, like nitrogen, the same kinds of things we put on our plants, that will create a potential hazard where the algae might start to grow in large numbers.
Is that something that state regulators are looking at trying to deal with from the from the agricultural side?
They actually are looking right now a lot at waste management. A lot of these chemicals, they're not just being produced with fertilizers, although they come from that.
Yeah.
But they also are coming from the water that comes out of our sewer systems that then goes back into our waterways. So they have, in 2014, they passed what they call technology-based limits. They're not water standards, because water standards are when they go in and they research what needs to be in this river for this river to be healthy, or this lake or puddle or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But in this case, they don't know for sure. That research isn't finished, and it's anticipating it could take quite a while. So they have created a kind of a temporary standard that just says we believe it's reasonable and possible technologically for these water treatment plants to install technologies that cap phosphorus at a certain level. And they believe that that should reduce the amount of phosphorus going into Utah's waters by about 50% to two-thirds.
Time frame on that? How long will that take
for them? It was passed in 2014. It goes into effect in 2020. They gave the water treatment plants some time to comply.
Emma Penrod's great reporting on this topic can all be found at sltrib.com. Listeners, we'd love to get your thoughts on this or any of the stories we are covering. Call us at 801-355-TALK with your questions. We can take them live on air, or you can leave them for us to discuss. You can also comment at sltrib.com in the comments section there. Again, thanks very much, Emma, for that reporting. So much to try and cover here. Annie Knox, I'm going to ask you to continue to be patient there for a little bit longer, because I want to stick with a couple of more environment-related stories. Sorry for that false start there. Robert Gerke, turning back to you, you reported on how The drastic drop in energy prices has been affecting eastern Utah and leading to a kind of milestone of sorts, something that hadn't happened here in Utah for at least 48 years. What was that?
Well, for every week for the last 48 years, there's been at least one drill rig operating in Utah. These are rigs that are drilling new wells. They usually come in and do a cluster of them, you know, and the energy prices have gotten so bad, and the future for the oil market has gotten so bad that for 2 weeks or 3 weeks, I believe, this year, there were actually zero drill rigs operating. And again, that's the first time in 48 years that's happened. And it kind of points to just the sort of the dire economic straits that the Uinta Basin and some of those counties in Duchesne and Uinta and, right, are facing right now. Their unemployment rate in Uinta County is 11.5%, which is more than triple the rate for the rest of the state. It's 11.1% in Duchesne County. It's a boom and bust industry, and we are in a bust right now. And I think there's some hope that maybe it's starting to turn around. The price of oil is kind of creeping back up, still below $50 a barrel, or it was the other day. And it also has consequences because these oil companies pay severance taxes to the state and to the federal government, but to the state, and they're anticipating that production this year will be 20% below what it was last year, and it's going to be another 10% lower next year. So that's sort of the situation that the basin is finding itself in right now.
Well, and you say that there's some hope that it might improve, but predictions from the state on oil production in particular don't look good.
Yeah, like I mentioned, that the prices are it's going to take not only prices coming up, but staying up and staying sustained for a period of time. Like I mentioned, production 20% off this year, 10% off next year. And that means that, those revenues aren't going to be coming in. The jobs are going to be slow to rebound. What they're hoping for is that we see a surge in pricing at some point and that it becomes economical again. What? One of the things that people are doing, and I talked to Senator Van Tassel, who's the senator who represents the district down there. He said that people are moving away. They're having homes that are going into foreclosure, or cars that are being repossessed, that sort of thing, just because the jobs are gone and people can't pay their bills. And it's having secondary consequences too, where the stores, doctors, people that end up getting paid by these jobs are.
What are the counties trying to do or doing about this? Is there, for example, any concerted effort to to build out other sectors of the economy?
Well, there's been efforts for a long time to try to recruit companies to come in, and there are some that are interested in coming in, but we're talking a few dozen jobs, maybe 50 to 60. And that just doesn't take the place, because each of those rigs that was operating, like I mentioned, I think there were 24, I believe, 2 years ago that were operating there. Each of those rigs creates 30 to 60 jobs, which is a lot, and they pay a lot. They pay up to like $80,000, $90,000 a year, and so it's hard to replace that with other
right.
Companies.
Sure, and the pay isn't the same. Well, an industry at a standstill and hitting people hard in Uinta County and Duchesne County. Robert Gerke, another story on the environment front that you reported on this week. The state of Utah is potentially tabling its lawsuit on federal public lands, at least for a little while. Maybe. Why is that?
Well, they need to wait and see who wins the presidential election and who's appointed to the Supreme Court. I think those are the two biggest factors right now. The concern that they have is that it's a 4-4 court right now. If we see Hillary Clinton win in November and appoint a liberal judge in early next year who's confirmed, then it's a 4-5 court, and I'm not sure that the state it changes all of your calculus. When Justice Scalia died, it went from a 5-4 court to that they thought they had a good chance of winning in. It changes the approach that they're going to have to take, and so they're waiting. They're still working on a draft of a complaint for this lawsuit that the legislature would like to see filed, or many of the legislators would like to see filed. That it demands that the federal government give the state 30 million acres of federal land. So they're proceeding on that complaint. They're getting some input from the attorney general. It would ultimately be up to the attorney general and governor to file it. But again, it's probably going to be early next year before we actually see any decision on that.
Well, and this brings us back to politics a little bit. Representative Ken Ivory, and I'm not certain, Managing Editor David Noyce, if you can address this, who wants this lawsuit and who has been deeply involved in the push for a Utah takeover of public lands, or maybe Robert, you can address this. He endorsed Governor Gary Herbert's challenger this week because of this very issue. Is that correct?
Yeah, there was an opinion piece that Ken Ivory wrote in the Tribune this week, and he knocks Governor Herbert pretty hard for not more being more aggressive in filing this lawsuit, and in other areas where federal pushback against the federal government's involved. But ultimately, it did say at the end of the article, it's about. Until Utah gets its land, it's going to be a colony, and Governor Herbert's not done enough to bring that about.
All right. Well, some fascinating dynamics at play in Utah politics, and you can read all about them in the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to have to take another short break. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. Listeners, join our conversation by posting a comment at sltrib.com or calling us at 801-355-TALK. We'll be back after a short break.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Devour Utah, a monthly magazine devoted to covering Utah's dining and drink scene with a spotlight on cooking, local happenings, and libations. Available at newsstands or online at devourutah.com.
The other night when I was putting him to bed, I was telling him how much I loved him. And I said to him, buddy, someday you are going to be a great father. And he kind of mumbled and said, Dad, one day you're going to be a great father too.
Join us next time for stories of fathers and children. The adventures, the joys, the predicaments. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Join us Saturday night at 6 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm KCPW producer Roger McDonough, joined in studio this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Robert Gerke, Emma Penrod, and Annie Knox, also managing editor David Noyce. And we are looking at this past week's news in review. We have a lot less time than we need for all the news that came out this week. Let's turn to some education news. Annie Knox, thank you for your patience here. You reported this week that the state is looking at getting rid of SAGE testing in Utah elementary and high schools. First off, maybe you can tell us what these tests are and what they measure.
Sure. The SAGE tests go to students in 3rd through 11th grade. It's an end-of-the-year test. Takes most of the day. I think what a lot of Utah educators would tell you is that SAGE is a good test that ended up in the wrong place at the wrong time, came on at least in its pilot phase around the same time as the National Common Core Standards. So both of those, the Common Core and SAGE, get a lot of flack for being kind of a federal mandate.
Right.
Neither are a federal mandate. SAGE was created in Utah by Utah teachers. But that hasn't stopped lawmakers this week from saying we need to take a hard look at it because the test has fallen out of favor with the public, with lawmakers, and with the governor, who said, I don't think we should use it for high school students anymore.
What's the major objection? I mean, by these people who are considering, education board members or the interim committee, education committee, what is the objection that they bring up, or what are they pointing to say we should consider getting rid of this?
There are quite a few. There are some lawmakers who say, we didn't do a good job of letting parents, families, students know what this test is all about and know what it's for. So there's kind of some reticence there because people don't really know what it's all about.
Hmm. 6.5 hours long, is that correct?
Yeah.
And is that the same, for a third grader as it is for an 11th grader?
It varies. The timing and the subject matter varies depending on what grade you're in. But there are a lot of people who have said, that's a long time for third graders, especially, to be sitting in front of a computer trying to type when they're just learning still how to navigate a keyboard.
Annie Knox, are these tests used to evaluate the students themselves or the schools or both?
They used to be used to evaluate teachers. That's no longer the case after lawmakers passed a law against that this past year.
Right.
So they're still used to evaluate students, but a lot of people have a gripe with that because they're not used in college acceptance. They're not used for students' grades. So some teachers and some families are saying, what's the motivation for students to do well? Why pay attention? Why give it their best shot?
But teachers, meanwhile, as you pointed out, have pointed to this being a worthwhile test, saying that it's a different kind of test. It's actually a kind of an adaptive test, one that isn't just memorizing answers. It's more about, I guess, asking questions that are drawing out more from the students.
Right. There was one educator from a representative from Weber School District who was at a meeting with legislators this past week, and that was her main concern. She said, we've taken a lot of time to get used to this. The scores are ticking up. And she said she really liked the standards or the test questions and the standards that teachers were teaching to, because they caused students to think a little bit more broadly and not just memorize for a variety of subjects, but especially for math. And there was another guy, a representative from Davis School District, who echoed that same concern. He said, we spent a long time trying to get students used to this test, trying to get teachers used to it. We're not ready to depart from it right now.
Well, and the state has a requirement that there be some sort of test to evaluate students. Is that correct? I mean, beyond say, ACTs and SATs for college admissions.
Right. And there was a representative this week, Marie Polson from Cottonwood Heights, the Democrat, and she said, you know, we've got to do this. We've got a relatively good system in place, but it needs some tweaks. Why don't we consider, she said, sprinkling pieces of the test throughout the school year, making it a little shorter so it's not a 6.5-hour block all at once. Or, she said, why don't we try giving the test every few years instead of every single year?
Hmm. So members of the Interim Education Committee mulled this over this week. Did they make any decisions about this test and its future?
No decisions yet, but they're expected to keep talking about it this summer.
Okay, in July. Well, Annie Knox, also on the education beat, you reported that the State Board of Education has decided to take a kind of novel approach to try and tackle a shortage of teachers in the state of Utah. What was their big idea on this?
Their move this past week was to allow people who have some experience in a career field, but who don't necessarily have a teaching degree or a license to basically get one. And how they can do that is a lot easier than it used to be. They don't have to have the degree, like I said. They don't have to work for a school district already. But they do have to pass an ethics test, get hired by the school district and have
a bachelor's degree,
yep. Have a mentor teacher that'll kind of oversee them and help them through for a few years.
Hmm. Is that a common practice in other states, having, so-called non-teacher teachers?
From what I understand, it's a lot looser. There are alternatives, at different school districts, different states, but they generally require a little bit more coursework and a little bit more familiarity with the system.
And this is about dealing with the fact that teachers in Utah, there's an absence of them. They leave after less than 5 years frequently. Are there detractors to the idea that having people who are not educated in becoming educators teach in classrooms?
Some people say this isn't the fix, that there are some broader problems here that you're going to have to address, and allowing more people who aren't teachers to become teachers quickly is not going to be the answer. We know that teachers are paid pretty low, especially in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
They have sort of a public relations problem, too. Last year, the state superintendent compared people at an education rally to kids wanting more toys on Christmas morning. So they feel like, I think a lot of people say, they're coming under fire and it's a hard, demanding job in the first place. You're not getting paid a lot. There are a lot of downsides.
Any efforts underway to try and pay teachers more to retain them?
That's the question. That's what they're going to be talking about in the next few legislative meetings, but I'm not sure, whether that's certain.
Okay, so the State Board of Education has essentially adopted this policy change. Is that a done deal, and can the public weigh in on this?
There's still time to weigh in on it, and it could go to a hearing if enough people demand one.
Okay. Okay, well, listeners, find more on the story at sltrib.com. We are low on time, but one thing we haven't yet covered on the show is the fact that following a mass shooting at a nightclub in Orlando, a vigil here in Utah drew some national attention because of statements by one Republican lawmaker, our lieutenant governor, in the spotlight. David Noyce, this was because of a moving speech by Spencer Cox, correct?
Yeah, we don't have much time, so I'll just say, you know, they laughed, they cheered, they cried after the speech. Not really. Spencer Cox... it was interesting. He had been invited to speak at a rally on Monday night, the day after the shooting, at Salt Lake City Hall. And Jim DeBacchus had invited him. And he planned, I think, giving off-the-cuff remarks. But he said before the speech, he found himself just unloading and in writing down his speech. It was sort of part confessional and part sort of a call to conscience.
Right.
Spencer Cox from rural Utah talked about how when he was in high school, he was cruel to some people and some kids and some classmates. And he just was. And he said, found out years later that those people were different. And the way they were different was that they were gay.
Right.
And he apologized for that. He said he'd had a change of heart. He thanked the LGBT community specifically for helping him to come to that realization. And then he sort of had a call to conscience for everybody. Specifically, he said, to the straight community. He said when people heard about the shooting in Orlando, Florida, and they heard that 49 people were gunned down by a self-proclaimed terrorist, what was your first response? And he says, now there's another question to ask. Did your response change when you found out that the shooting was at a gay nightclub at 2 a.m. in the morning? And he said, if your response changed, then there's something wrong here. Hmm. Obviously, the implication being that we need to have a lot more caring and compassion for people who maybe people haven't had that sometimes. And then he challenged the nation, and Utah specifically, to change their hearts, too, if they needed to, on both sides of the aisle. From the LGBT community, that he said it doesn't do any good to call people bigots or fascists or communists or whatever with comments that they might make, and also certainly on maybe straight people who still harbor some kind of bias or animosity toward the LGBT community. Mm-hmm. He said we need a lot fewer Democrats, a lot fewer Republicans, and a lot more Americans.
Right.
And our video of it went everywhere.
It's true. It's gone around the world and has been tweeted out by Hillary Clinton and has been shared on multiple sites. Lots of aggregating content here.
Right.
Well, and this is, of course, at a time when the nation is considering changing or considering what our gun policies might be. And the Salt Lake Tribune editorial board weighed in on this week as well, correct?
Yes, they did. And I'm not sure how much sway that will have. And there are votes in the Senate on Monday. Of course, no one expects any of the votes to pass. The Republicans will have their votes. This is the U.S. Senate.
Right.
And the Democrats will have theirs, some calling for stricter gun measures. There was a 15-hour filibuster in the Senate this week trying to get those things moving. And of course, no one expects those to pass or have any lasting policy change. Didn't happen after Newtown, Connecticut. So it's most people think it's hard to see that happening here.
Hmm. Well, Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor David Noyce, some poignant moments in the Utah response to the massacre in Orlando. Coverage available at sltrib.com. Guys, we've reached that time. It's time for our final segment, the Underplayed Stories of the Week. And David Noyce, have you got anything sticking with you?
I do. We had a story this week of a Utah entrepreneur who has a vision for a Provo neighborhood, Pleasant View neighborhood near BYU and the Missionary Training Center. A man named David Hall, who has a lot of money and wants to develop a kind of eco-friendly, futuristic, yet throwback
utopian
community. Utopian community, yes, that would squeeze 20,000 people into as little as 1 square mile. His vision is inspired by, of all people, Joseph Smith, the Mormon church founder, and his Plat of Zion in 1833. I'm not sure Joseph Smith envisioned LED toilets, but anyway, that's what he wants to do. And, of course, the Provo neighborhood, their single-family homes, is fighting that as our city officials. But he is buying up homes there in hopes that one day he can pull this. He feels like this is the future. it's anti-sprawl, and it's more eco-friendly.
Okay, a vision for the future in Provo. Annie Knox, how about yourself? What's your pick for an underplayed story of the week?
Okay, I don't think you could overplay this story. Our colleague Jennifer Dobner, wrote a really nice piece about the role of gay bars and gay nightclubs in Salt Lake City as havens for members of the LGBT community. And how that's threatened now in the wake of the Orlando massacre. So it was a really nice look at what role the bars have played and how that's changing now.
All right. Check out Jennifer Dobner's story at sltrib.com. Robert Gerke, how about yourself?
Well, there was a hearing this week at the Utah legislature about death with dignity and you know, the right to die. And this is an issue that's sort of been a back burner issue for a number of years, but I think it's gaining, you know, it's gaining more attention in Utah and elsewhere. And there was an action taken, but I think it's teeing up an issue that's going to be discussed a lot in the coming months.
In the next legislative session, perhaps.
Perhaps,
as well.
Yeah. Rebecca Chavez-Houck has sponsored legislation in the past on this issue. She's going to be sponsoring it again. But it's getting hearings and people are talking about it now.
Okay. Emma Penrod, how about yourself for an underplayed story of the week?
I saw this morning a story that just came out about, I guess there are three wildfires, lightning-sparked wildfires in southern Utah burning right now. Limited containment, some homes maybe potentially threatened. There are some ranches there. No evacuations yet. But, you know, there's also fires in California. It's just an interesting issue to follow right now is wildfire in the West. For some reason, we're seeing an increase in wildfires.
Increase in intensity, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Wow. And they're not sure. You know, people have attributed this to global warming. They've attributed it to our past land management strategies that have tried to put out all wildfires, producing more fuel for future wildfires. But it's just an interesting issue to follow right now.
Definitely. All right. For my part, I'll go with a story that, Emma, you wrote that we didn't get to touch on this week about efforts to create a regional power grid across the western United States and the roadblocks that it's hitting, as well as what it might mean potentially for energy production in Utah. Again, all of this coverage available at the Tribune's website. Well, Emma Penrod, Robert Gerke, Annie Knox, and David Noyce, thanks to all of you for joining me this morning on Behind the Headlines.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby reflects on something that he'd never done before until this past weekend.
I officiated at the wedding of a gay couple. The son of some friends of mine was getting married, and they asked me if I would be the officiant. I'd done it before for other couples, but this was a first for me.
But it wasn't the first time that you were asked to, officiate a same-sex marriage in general, right?
Oh, no. I'd been asked a couple times before. Both of them had fallen through.
Well, I was hoping that you could maybe read to us a little bit of that part of your column.
Yes. I wrote, "This wasn't the first time I've been asked to perform a same-sex marriage. Last year, two women wanted me to officiate their wedding. I agreed. Unfortunately, they broke up before the big day. Then there was the other gay couple who asked. After weeks of talking their parents into grudgingly attending the offensive ceremony, one of the grooms called the day before and uninvited me. His uber-Mormon mother had put her foot down. She would not attend his wedding if that nasty man from the Tribune was there. Is that great or what? At a same-sex marriage in ultra-conservative Utah, it's a newspaper hack rather than gay people whose presence is the most objectionable. Damn, I love irony."
I have to ask if that previous couple found somebody at the last minute to marry them.
Yes, they did. And they were very apologetic about it. But ultimately, the most important event in your life, which, you know, should be finding your soulmate or whatever, is really a family thing, because those are the people you're going to lean on for support when things don't go as well as you hope they did. And so when he asked me to step aside in favor of his mother, even though she didn't like the fact that he was gay, I understood.
But she would be there.
Yes.
But not if you were there.
Well, I actually get that a lot, so it didn't bother me.
Well, so at this wedding this past weekend, a hiccup or two, and it rained a lot, but otherwise went off as planned. And in your writing, you end up kind of meditating on faith and on love. There's a little bit of Forrest Gump in there as well. Can we hear that part?
Yeah. I don't know a lot about divinity, theology, doctrine, dogma, or whatever it is that some people use to explain God's mind to the rest of us. When it comes to love, I have to go with Forrest Gump's. I'm not a smart man, but I know what love is. Despite almost nothing going according to plan Saturday evening, a drenched Andrew and Jed were definitely in love. A blindfolded person could have seen it, and only a fool would have believed it to be anything else.
I want to ask you about the response you received to the column, but before I get there, you close with an observation about a kind of juxtaposition for that joyful occasion and what soon followed thereafter.
Being different, or in this particular case, gay, in a society where that's still very unconventional, is tough. And I was struck by the irony that only a few hours after I married them, there was a massacre in Orlando of gay people.
Yeah.
And so it occurred to me that despite how happy they were and despite how wonderful they felt at that moment, Andrew and Jed were always going to have to struggle to be secure and safe in their relationship around so many people who condemn it.
How has the public response to this article been? I mean, I don't know if you're somebody who follows the comments section, but what kind of response have you got?
I don't follow the comments section all that much because usually it swings off into a dogfight about something else very quickly.
Of course.
But I pay attention to Facebook, and it's been almost overwhelmingly positive. And the really strange thing is that I was getting likes from people in my ward and LDS stake who I would have never imagined would have felt that way about this particular issue.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find all of his opinions at sltrib.com. And that does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW Public Radio, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks again to Robert Gerke, Emma Penrod, Annie Knox, and David Noyce for joining all of us today here on Behind the Headlines. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams, and Bennett Purser at Utah Public Radio, and Emily Means with the Salt Lake Tribune. There's much more on all of these stories at sltrib.com. And a quick note on a preview. Join us for a Salt Lake Tribune Town Hall Forum on June 30th at 7 p.m. at the Leonardo in downtown Salt Lake City, looking at confronting rape culture at Utah colleges. Again, that's a town hall forum on June 30th, 7 p.m. at the Leonardo in downtown Salt Lake City, put on by the Salt Lake Tribune, confronting rape culture at Utah colleges. Don't miss it. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW. Thanks again for tuning in. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend, everybody.